Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hey everyone, it's Jenny. I'm doing a quick Santa Cruz interview. I've interviewed Therese Kilpatrick, who some of you might remember from the London mechanicking cycling scene. So she was one of the original mechanics at Mosquito Bikes, which is now defunct.
Been swatted.
Squatted.
It's not funny, is it?
And she went on to work for herself and then also worked at Look Mum No Hands and worked at London Bike Kitchen. And now she lives in Santa Cruz.
Oh, my God. Living the dream.
Yeah, she did some work at Santa Cruz Bikes. Now she's kind of semi-retired. But got an interview with her about kind of her life and how she got into bikes. Yeah, here you go.
We're going to play that for you now.
Yeah.
Okay. My name's Therese. I'm currently living in Santa Cruz, California, and I am just finished working with an organization called Project Bike Tech, which is a nonprofit designed to teach bicycle mechanics in high schools in the U.S. And I was instrumental in helping develop the curriculum for it. There was some curriculum when I started about 6 years ago, but it hadn't been coordinated or organized into a format that was able to be shared to other school districts and class and high schools. So what? And the other thing it needed to do to get accreditation in California to be allowed to be taught as it was an ROP class to start out with. Anyway, I'm going on too much about this, but anyway,
that's interesting.
It needed to have something called a stream or I can't remember the exact word, but it had to have two classes basically in it. So I had to develop level one and level two, mm-hmm. and then get that approved by the California's university entrance requirements as an elective, which is a G category. So I did that. I spent a couple years doing that, working with Project Bike Tech, developing that. So that was approved at the end of 2017, I think.
Cool.
And then I worked last year helping. Well, what I did, I hadn't actually finished off doing it, so someone else finished the project. But the level two was also approved for a G category for UC entrance.
And so that enabled young people to then
get
take these classes
and get credit
and
for
get credit.
It. Yeah,
that's awesome.
And it also made it a lot easier to kind of sell. I'm doing quotes to other school districts because a lot of them want to have the gold standard. Basically, for that is the California standard. So that made it a lot easier for Project Bike Tech to take it to other places like
states.
Colorado. Yeah, like other states, Colorado and Vermont, where it's now being taught.
Oh, very cool.
So that was the last sort of bicycle industry job I was doing as a sort of freelance curriculum developer. And also concurrently with that, I was teaching high school bicycle tech in high school at a local high school in Aptos High for 5 years, which was very enlightening. if you've never taught teenagers, it's pretty intense and it's very rewarding, but it's also there's a lot of challenges. Let's put it that way.
I can imagine. Okay. I mean, I know.
yeah. You've done a lot of work with young people too. So to get that job, I had to have had work in the industry. At least I think the requirements were like 5 years within, and then 3 of those years being within the last 5 years. So I had that because previous to that, I was working at a bicycle factory called Santa Cruz Bikes for about 18 months. And I was working in the wheel department there. Basically, my first time I've ever worked in a bicycle factory. And it was quite enlightening to work on that side, the wholesale, or the people who supply bicycles, rather than the retail side, which all my previous experience had been basically in retailing or teaching. So that was very interesting. I made a lot of contacts. It was interesting to network with people who were also in the bicycle industry in the U.S., and I still have, you know, sort of ties with Santa Cruz Bikes. I would, you know, if I ever wanted to go work back and work there, they said just come back and they'll hire me again.
Do you want to?
Not really. I think factory jobs, they have their purpose and they're good. They're a good starting out place, but they're very labor intensive and it's hard on your body to work on the factory. Like when I was working there as well, as a woman, there was only two of us working on the factory floor. There were other women who worked in the other aspects of the company, but basically actually working on bikes themselves. There was only myself and one other woman called Max.
Out of how many?
I think there was probably about 100 people working there when I was working there. It's gone up from there now. I think they've even got more employees. Actually, Santa Cruz Bikes is doing really well. They're trying to increase their productivity. That was interesting working on that side of things, the wholesale side rather than the retail side. Prior to that, I was living in the United Kingdom in London for 26 years, and most of those years I was working in the bicycle industry in the retail side. Mm-hmm. So I started out at about age 25, roughly, working at a bicycle shop that no longer exists called Mosquito Bikes, which was at that point a cooperative, a workers' cooperative, which was pretty cool. They were up for training people. I got a lot of training. They were very supportive of minorities and women who were underrepresented in the bicycle industry and sadly are still underrepresented in the bicycle industry.
Is this in the 90s?
That was 89 when I first started. Yeah. And I worked there as one of the co-owners for about 13 years.
Wow.
We transformed from being a workers' co-op several years in to being owned by four owners. Actually, initially five owners, and then it became four owners. So I had a lot of training and learned a lot from being in the retail and, you know, profit and loss, being a small business, essentially, in a part of London called Essex. Well, it was Essex Road, which is part of Islington, which is a borough in London. My experience of doing that was that I was very keen, and the direction I like to see the company going in was about empowering people to be, you know, conscious of climate change, ride bikes more, promote bike riding amongst women and minorities and people who are lower socioeconomic scale, which is very difficult because a lot of people have the image, and they probably still do, that bikes are either for kids or recreation. You know, you got to be some sort of nerd to ride a bike, which is kind of different than a lot of other European countries where bikes are seen as just another form of transportation. Mm-hmm. And it's very commonplace for practically everybody of every social scale to ride bikes to and from work. And there's provision for them. There's actually, you know, bike lanes and a lot of infrastructure, which there isn't in London. There's more than there was, you know, in 89, but it's still not, you know, it's not the paradise for bike riders that it ought to be, really.
Not close.
And obviously people have the objections about the weather, you know, it was wet a lot. And I would say the statistics is it only rains about 14 days in the year, really consistently enough to be off-putting, really.
Yeah, you're only going to get drenched once.
Yeah. And obviously if you have the proper protective, you know, rainwear and all the rest, you know, you're going to be affected by it less. And so I spent many, many years just encouraging people to get on bikes, selling them bikes, usually entry level, commuting bikes, and encouraging people to just make it part of their life, you know, change their lifestyle. They're already encouraged to anyway. They came into the bike shop to get a bike. Yeah. And be educated about what it meant to be a commuter. You know, you just, obviously security is a huge, huge factor. If you buy a new bike and you're really happy and then, you know, two weeks later it gets stolen, you're like, you know, devastated. And then you got to, you know, maybe have insurance, probably not. And then come back in and need to buy another bike, et cetera, repeat the whole process. So there was obviously all that is a detriment or an obstacle to some people to buying a bike. Anyway, so from there, eventually the bike shop I was working with and my fellow co-owners decided to move our shop in a different direction. They really wanted to specialize in high-end road bikes, which are great and beautiful. They're like kind of like jewelry, you know, you can, you know, they're functional jewelry, but they're also jewelry because if you're spending entry-level kind of road bikes are kind of 800-900 pounds or above to get something that's lightweight and latest state-of-the-art sort of thing. And there's a very small number of people who probably, you know, proportionally, who can go out and buy those state-of-the-art, you know, latest carbon fiber, you know, 12 gears on the back wheel, kind of, you know, super, super high tech bikes, which is great for them. And I, you know, I'm glad for them. I really want them to be able to buy bikes too, and et cetera. But it seems to me that the majority of people just need a functional, dependable, reliable bike mm-hmm. that's, you know, supported by good mechanics who can either, if they're going to look after it themselves, or probably just bring it into a bike shop to get serviced regularly. That's the far outweighs the number of people who can just come in with a Goldman Sachs credit card and buy a $5,000 bike. You know?
Yeah.
So so that's the direction our shop is going in. And I was kind of like, well, I'm leaving. You know, I kind of left then. That was about 2002. And I started over again. So I went and worked for another bike shop called London Field Cycles, which again doesn't exist now. They'll go into the reasons for that later. So I just started out as a bicycle mechanic. I just said, look, you know, I've been a shop owner, and they were really pleased to have me work for them. And they were also the two owners of London Fields were very encouraging for women to ride bikes, and they were very progressive people.
Mm.
But I was basically a bike mechanic.
You weren't a bike mechanic at Mosquito.
I had some training. I could do basic stuff, but yeah. I'd never learned wheel building at that stage, mm-hmm. and I didn't feel as confident as some of the guys who obviously, you know, spent their whole time taking things apart and putting things back together again repeatedly. And so, but when I went to London Fields and I worked there for 3 years full time, I really got to that level of being like really confident mm-hmm. that I could do anything on a bike or teach myself if I didn't know it. And I learned to wheel build, and I learned, you know, just a lot of essential things, which I really have to, you know, thank. I had a few mentors. Joe was one of the owners. He taught me a lot. Robin also taught me a lot. And a guy called Greg, who was working there. And so I got a lot of good training mm-hmm. from people who were very experienced bike mechanics. And there was a really good shop. I mean, they had a really good ethos. They expanded. They moved premises into a big shop. And anyway, so eventually I left them and went with another person. We set up a small bike repair business in Hackney City Farm. So this must have been about 2008.
Mm.
We got funding. We went for kind of a bit like a Shark Tank where you go for where nonprofits could go and apply to get a grant. Forgetting whether it was a grant or a loan. Anyway, that doesn't matter. We got money.
You got the money.
We got money to start up. Yeah, as just a bet. We basically, our business plan was just to do repairs. A few things, like we would sell inner tubes, obviously, and pumps mm-hmm. and, you know, cables, et cetera. But we weren't really set up to be a retail outlet.
Yeah.
Our premise was to just, like, ride a bike. You can come in on the spot. We'll just do repairs for you, et cetera. And that we did that for about 2 years. Roughly, nearly 2 years. I just thought, again, it was just the approach was to just teach people as much as I could. You know, people want to come and watch me do repairs. I'd say, yeah, that's fine mm-hmm. if you got the time, or otherwise just drop it off and we'll do it for you. At the same time, I was also teaching bicycle mechanics as a kind of not, how do I put it? I was doing it. It was kind of a nonprofit because I'd started up a nonprofit called the Bike Project or the Hackney Bike Project.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of that, this was going on concurrently, I was like, the aim of that was to teach people to become bike mechanics. Yeah. That was always my thing, was like, you know, to empower people, it's better to learn if you can. And there's some things that's, you know, beyond you if you haven't got tools and space to do it. But generally, like the London Cycling Campaign, the idea was, you know, have these spaces where people learn about bike mechanics hands-on. So I taught a 1-day class every month on Sundays, and doing bike mechanics. And
that was at Hackney City Farm.
Nice. Yeah, that was at Hackney City Farm. And I also did a lot of work with Hackney Bike Project. We did a lot of sort of freelance teaching. Transport for London had various different schemes. They wanted us to, you know, they'd set up to teach people bike mechanics, the basics, to encourage them to get off to alternative forms of transport besides buses and tubes and things, because, you know, they were trying to encourage people to get bikes. So there were schemes aimed at people also as refugees. There was another scheme that I worked with to help people get learn bike mechanics and mm-hmm. get, like, an earn a bike.
Yeah,
so they'd cobble together a bike and then they'd have that to, because a lot of people were refugees, had no ways, means of getting any kind of benefits. They were basically just left to kind of sink or swim, essentially.
Yeah.
And, you know, having a bike was just essential. They would be really, really, really thankful to be able to have a bike and just be able to, you know, ride. All these different projects were worked out really well. As for being a woman in the bike industry, it's always been my ethos to sort of like, well, I don't, just if someone is skeptical of me as a bike mechanic, I say, well, you know, like, I'll explain, you know, I've studied, I have a qualification in it, taught many people the basics, and I feel pretty confident in that. And, you know, if someone can take it or leave it, you know, if they're probably never going to be accepting of women being in a different kind of industry. If they're not, you know, if they've got that mindset that women can't do certain things, then that's just too bad. But I try not to let it affect me. And I made a lot of good friends who are also other women bike mechanics who are still in London, like you, Jenny, and a few others who work either with me at the bike project, Hackney Bike Project, or they worked as cycle trainers, or you know, various different connections I have with women who've either been or been in other bike shops. You know, at Brixton Cycles, I think she's left. I mean, I know she's left, but she's very amazing bike mechanic called Mel. And the woman who used to have the bicycle workshop out in West London.
Ninon.
Yeah. I think she retired.
She retired.
She was always an inspiration to me. So there was always older women who were out there before you, even if you just come into it. So I really encourage women to really try it. If you want something that's very rewarding and hands-on, and if you just love bikes, because it kind of gets in your blood, really, I think.
It does,
and
yeah.
It's really hard to not be involved in them, although I am at the moment not being too involved. Yeah, just kind of obsessed with behavior. You know, there's always a factor of, you know, if the fallback thing is generally everywhere in the world, there's people who ride bikes. And generally, if you just persevere with it and you need a job, you know, you can get a job as a bike mechanic pretty much anywhere, even in today's internet, you know, retail environment where it's very hard to have a retail shop. The mechanics part is always going to be going and strong because people are always going to buy stuff that then they don't know how to fix, or they haven't got the time to fix because they're working, you know, really, really hard hours, and they haven't, you know, it's sort of a trade-off of time or money sort of thing. So being a bike mechanic is a really useful and survivalist, you know, I think the more skills you have, the better. Whatever. And obviously it can lead on to other things if you're that kind of person that has, I think of it as like an engineering mind. I don't know, sort of a mind that you might think, well, that's great, but actually I want to learn more. And then you might go on and become an engineer, or you might do something even more, you know, fantastic, like work for NASA or something like that. It's open-ended.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I was wondering if getting bike mechanics into like elementary school things.
What? Okay, there's two things about that. First of all, yes, to a limited degree because of hand strength. When you have a young child, I sort of put the threshold around about 9, 10, 11, because the hand strength, it's difficult unless you have specialist tools that are extra long for leverage. Torque wrenches are good because then you can say, look, let's measure how much you can actually tighten this bolt, and is it going to be safe or not, and explain all those instances, which teaches so much about maths. It's so STEM. You have a thing called STEM in the UK?
STEM,
science, technology, engineering, and math. Yeah, so it's related to that. I mean, it's a perfect thing to teach for that.
Yeah.
That's the threshold I kind of put it, and also in terms of been able to concentrate long enough to sort of get the full lesson. And, you know, you can have breaks and such like that.
Have the shortest attention span.
Yeah, it's working with young people. And obviously you can't say a blanket statement that somebody, you know, obviously someone who's 8 is intelligent enough generally to learn how to wheel build.
Oh, yeah.
It's just, you know, will they sit there? Will they have the patience and want to do it? You know, like, yeah, maybe. So there's certain, obviously there's ones who have and do.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't say no to that. And the other thing is the kind of marriage between bike tech and cycle tech, like actually being able to ride and learn road sense and safety, that kind of goes hand in hand with it. So I think programs that could put them together really work well, because the template for that I kind of got that's hopefully still going on and is and I was really impressed with is something called Star Bikes in
Gale.
Gail Bispo is, she didn't start it, but she's been there a long time, longer than when I joined them. So they were doing cycle training in at the elementary school level, right down to just learning basic balance bikes. So they would have, and they incorporated families in it. Mm-hmm. So they would say, look, you know, come parents come too, we'll train you. So you could all go for rides together and encouraging family, it's as a family, activity. And then also obviously teaching, you know, balance skills and cycle and, you know, learning to hand signal and all that stuff. And then riding on the road. It's a holistic way of looking at it. So and then some of that is training them, you know, how to do the ABC check kind of idea. Like, you know, check.
Air brakes chain.
Yeah, air brake chain. And, you know, even little kids can understand, you know, like, I know I can't do it, but I know what's wrong. Something's wrong with it. And that's really taking on, empowering them to be like, I'm responsible for it. I'm the pilot of this bike, so I want to, you know, make sure it's good. So if the handlebars are loose, I'll know how to check it. And, you know, even if I'm not strong enough to tighten it tight enough, I can say to someone else, that needs tightening. You know, so that's really cool.
No, that's a really good point. They do go hand in hand. But I don't think that's happening right now. That's why
I hope Star Bikes changed. I don't know if it's still going, but I hope it is. Or programs like Star Bikes are really important. Here they have something called the Cycle Rodeos, where they go to schools. And I think what they do is they have kind of cycle training, the idea, and they have like a parking lot or somewhere, and they put cones out, and you ride around, and they have an obstacle course. So it's a bit like a rodeo. The idea is that you're riding your bike and having fun. I haven't actually participated in them, but I do know that they're very... that they have a similar program over here with that. And I think they probably go through basics of how to fix your puncture and things like that.
Cool.
With them too.
You've worked in both the UK and US.
Yeah.
Have you noticed similarities, differences in the two?
I would say just from living here, which is a very cycle-identified kind of city, you know, Santa Cruz. I mean, there's a lot of history of mountain biking, especially. I think people think of mountain biking kind of originating here, although I think it's originated everywhere. But, you know, they have this concept that the West Coast was like, yeah, Marin and Santa Cruz. There's bicycle history that goes back, you know, nearly 50 years now, or however many years, 40 years?
Something like that.
Anyway, since the 70s. And that it's very liberating. So the bikes they're not so much seen, I think, from people in the US over here that I've met so far as commuting bikes. That's a new thing-ish. It's kind of new because people have seen bikes as recreation, you know, a sport, as fitness. And you, for example, you get your 4x4, like, big truck, and you put your mountain bikes in the back of it, and you ride up to a mountain, and then you go riding, and then you come back, and then you've had a great time with your friends, and maybe smoked a bowl or whatever as well. You know, it's like a very laid-back kind of hippie, quasi-hippie kind of thing. Some people are very into it, and they race. You know, there's a race scene, obviously. And it's kind of connected a little bit as well to, like, the motorbike scene, the off-road, the dirt motorbike scene too. So a lot of people are into mountain bikes, might also be into dirt bikes, might be into 4x4s, might be into, you know, outdoor pursuits, as it were, anyway, you know, kind of ethos. And less like my experience of living in London for so many years was like bikes were like, you put on all your waterproofs, you grab your lights and your massive heavy lock, and you like pedal off to work. And you have a good time, and I think everyone feels better after having a bike ride, but then, you know, you're not thinking of it as sport, you're not thinking of it as recreation so much. It's like, it's my means to an end. Yeah. It's in my toolbox. I've got my bike, and it's just very serious. It's very, like, you might, and some people who are really into it might go, yeah, I'll go biking in the weekends too. You know, I won't bring all that stuff and I'll just go for a nice ride, you know, on the round lanes or somewhere or off road or something. But it's kind of, there's definitely crucial differences in that. There's fewer people, I think, who do have big pickups in the UK that they put their bikes in and drive up to the mountains and mountain bike. There's probably some. But the people I remember that I would hook up with for mountain biking, we'd go, well, we got to get the train. Yeah. meet at this train station at, you know, early hour, get somewhere in the country, stop for a pub lunch, you know, go for a nice ride, come back. And you're generally wet and muddy because it's usually wet.
Yeah.
And then, you know, he had a great time, but it's like, it's a little bit different here. It's much more like less rain anyway, I think, generally.
More sun.
Yeah. In terms of proportions of women to men, I think probably it's about the same in terms of off-roading. I would say a lot of women do a lot of mountain biking here and fitness. There's a lot of emphasis on fitness and, you know, wearing your Fitbit and going out and doing whatever, jogging or mountain biking or whatever. And but the commuting thing, I think that's going to come. My prediction is that because of
Santa Cruz.
I think so. I think so more. There's been jump bikes here, which are these pay by the hour kind of
rent them
community bike. I don't know what you call them really.
Hire bikes.
That's the word. Yeah, hire bikes. And I think that's changed a lot of people's opinions about riding, especially into town, because it's hard to park, hard to find parking. It is hilly here, slightly hilly. For me, it's like really hilly.
It's hilly.
And that's off-putting, but having an electric bike available to give you that extra assist is encouraging. I think more people are doing it. And then sometimes, I think, I don't know the statistics, but from what I've been reading in the kind of the bicycle, what do you call it, the industry paper, the magazine, they're saying, you know, like up to 50%, some bike shops are finding that the electric bikes are, you know, selling way, you know, that's really what's propping up the industry is electric bikes to a certain extent, because there's a lot of aging boomers who are going, right, I'd love to go, but I can't keep up with the younger folk who want to go faster, or, you know, I can't really, you know, when you're 80 and you're trying to ride along, kind of creep along slowly, or even, you know, slightly stout like myself, then it's, you know, you just look at young people in their Lycra and going, that looks so fun, being really Zoom, but, you know, like me, yeah. So electric bikes, I think, on one hand, are a really good thing for encouraging a lot of people who probably wouldn't participate in doing it, and women who would think, you know, if they go riding, if their partner is faster than them and fitter and, you know, more used to it, and then they can't really, you know, it's not an equal ride if they're going ahead and then they're having to wait for you or whatever, you know, it's not something activity you would possibly do together because, you know, the disparity.
Yeah.
So I think they're good. I think they're a good idea.
E-bikes are the future.
Yeah. But as a mechanic, on the other hand, the downside is that it's making bikes become like computers or anything else that's, you know, have you got the latest technology? Oh no. Well then, you know, or your battery dies or, you know, or hopefully not get stolen. You know, you daren't try to fix it because it's, you know, it's an electric bike. There's an electric system now on it. And how do you deal with that?
It's become more complicated.
And even bike mechanics or who haven't been exposed to them much, you know, are going, whoa.
Yeah, not going to touch it.
I'm not going to touch it. Yeah, exactly. So there's good and bad in it. But I think it is the future, though, because you think the proportion of population in the U.S. who could potentially ride bikes who might not because of the obstacles. I mean, one big obstacle with electric bike is the price. They're usually for pretty, you know, reasonably well off people because you can't, you know, starting prices are from probably $1,000.
Hopefully with increased supply will come a decrease in price.
Yeah, I think Bosch can't keep up with the demand.
I bet,
the people who do the batteries. So that's going to bring other people into it because if there's demand, there'll be supply, and the people will come in with cheaper options that, you know, whether they're good, I don't know.
Yeah, that's the other.
Because the standard's kind of that sort of German technology, isn't it?
I think that's it.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Therese.
Well, you're very welcome,
Jenny.
It is. It's been wonderful, and you've been inspiring to me, actually, because you got together your nonprofit. Has set premises, which mine I never really find it really kind of figured that out, but yeah, it's challenging to try to do what we're doing,
yeah,
what we did, but it's helping so many people is that you got to think about that, the results.
Well, you helped lay the foundation, standing on the shoulders of giants.
Yeah. I have a lot of Bagman Kings to thank, who taught me.
Yeah, Therese is great. Okay, funny, weird side story. We were staying at her house while my boyfriend and I were traveling up and down the coast of California. And their dog got into it with a skunk and ran into the house where we were and just skunked us all. It was skunk.
Was it holding the skunk and then squirted it at you?
No, okay. No. It had gotten sprayed by a skunk.
So it was skunked.
Yeah.
And then it skunked you.
I've always smelled skunk from afar, or the marijuana version, which does not smell anything like actual real skunk. Real skunk is like, bam, in your face. It's very strong, like... it's musky, inky, chemically. It's really weird. It's amazing that it's like this natural funk.
Like, does it make you want to throw up?
Yeah, kind of. If you're around it too much. There's a bit of mothball in there as well. Mm. And it stuck on our clothes. We had to change all our clothes. And Therese and her partner were like, oh, you're going to, that smell's going to be with that particular clothing for like 4 months. And I'm like, ah.
So could I skunk my bike to stop someone stealing it?
Yeah, but then you'd have to ride it afterwards. I think somebody made a lock, didn't they?
That squirts.
A lock
skunk.
That would squirt a bad smell. But anyway, so that was the highlight of the trip. Oh, that and I spoke at the Marin Museum of Bicycling and Mountain Bike Hall of Fame with, like, you know, Joe Breeze, Connie Breeze, Jackie Phelan. I did a talk there. It is recorded and it's on LBK's Facebook page. However, I totally had a brain fart at the beginning and I lost my... I practiced. I was so nervous. I'm usually not nervous with public speaking anymore, but this one I was because I was like, wow, these people are like... bicycle legends. And I totally forgot at the beginning. And it felt like a minute, but my boyfriend assures me it was about 5 seconds. And then I kind of got back on. But I was kind of, you know, when you like, you lose it and you're like, oh, I never got it back. Like, I tried.
Oh.
And I think it was fine because everyone was really stoked afterwards. But I've done better. But it was still like an honor to be there and speak and be around all these amazing bikes. Ah, love it.
Everybody brain farts.
Yeah.
It's okay. It's okay to brain fart.
If you like what we do, rate us on iTunes. Smash that like button and subscribe. If you can't give us your money, give us your stars. And don't forget to share us with your friends.
Please.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.